eco y su sombra a mí me parece un eco y la sueño triste y también riendo a mí me dejó su recuerdo.
Welcome to Women's Focus Show. This afternoon I'll be hosting this show, sitting in for Carol Boss. She'll be back on May the 20th. My name is Cristina Bacin, and today we are our main topic is because April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So on Women's Focus, we are going to talk about how the life of a sexual assault victim is affected. Do you wonder if it's possible to overcome a sexual assault? More questions, and in our panel, we'll have joining us today Bianca Villani from the Community Education, is a Community Education and Outreach Director at the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico. Welcome, Bianca.
Thank you very much. Honored to be here.
Yes, and thank you for coming with this weather. And Elena Giacci, who is a DINE woman, first of all, and a sexual and domestic violence training specialist, advocate for American Indian and Alaskan Native peoples. Welcome, Elena Giacci, to our show as well.
Thank you so much for being here.
And we also want to let our listeners know that we'll have the testimonies of two sexual assault survivors. One will be Julia, the other Sarah. We are covering their names. And also we'll have Claire Harwell in a recording interview, who served over 500 survivors in a five-year period and established a statewide system to address civil legal rights of sexual assault survivors. And then after this part of the show, we'll also have some art regarding women. In this case, we're going to have an interview with Lebanese-born Simone de Baz, and she's presenting her new exhibition about ethnic Madonnas, which is an allegory of femme. So lots of things going on in our today's Women's Focus show. Again, my name is Cristina Bacin, sitting in today for Carol Boss, who will be back on May the 20th.
Você não me diz nada, mas eu digo pra você. Você por mim não chora, mas eu choro por você. Você por mim não chora, mas eu choro por você.
So the first thing with which we're going to begin is a very courageous poem presented by Simone Wardney, who is a high school student, 17 years old, and she presented this poem at the recent art exhibit organized by the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico as part of this Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So let's listen to Simone, this poem. Very powerful one.
I've been told I'm pretty, I've been catcalled, I've been stalked, and how do these compliments make me feel? I feel pretty objectified, like the girls in Vogue. Oh, they're so pretty, all skin and bone, more bones than clothes, lying submissively, seductively, beneath a man who stands with perversive power sexual, her eyes wide with a pleasure that could easily be confused with fear or pain. I'm sure she feels so pretty. Pretty, like the kind of girls jocks are into, so pretty it drowns out their refusal, because pretty is a boy's weakness, and he's so bright and full of potential. But what about her? Excuse me if I'm wrong here, but I don't see pretty spelled out in potential. And when he touched her crawling skin with his blessed fingertips, I bet she felt so pretty. I've been told I'm pretty, I've been called big butt, I've been denied when I requested greedy hands to stop, because God, baby, you're just too hot. And how do these compliments make me feel? I feel pretty violated. I feel pretty worthless. I feel pretty dizzy. And God, why this raging headache? Probably because I've been restricting my intake, living solely off of coffee the past 2 days so I can feel pretty. Because I only feel pretty when I am empty and docile and passive and weak. Because isn't that the most attractive thing when your hands light up my thigh and I tell you to stop, but they reach into my pants and I don't fight you off, so you tell me I'm pretty? And Jesus Christ, I'm so tired of hearing that fucking word. I'm tired of bending over backwards, going out of my way to fit that pretty mold. It's not as if I look pretty for me. It's just that pretty is an easier pill for you to swallow. But why should I care about how easily I go down your throat when it's yours that has fit labels and guidelines that my body is expected to follow? I'd rather be a foam dinosaur that expands in water so I can clog your bastard throat and prevent you from ever again muttering that word, because I bet you then I'd feel pretty brave. I'd feel pretty strong. I'd feel pretty accepted without needing your approving touch or actually feel wanted outside of the times I'm being violated.
You are listening to Simone Wardney. She is a 17-year-old high school student in Albuquerque, and she composed this poem and also an exhibition that, Bianca, you were also organizing this one, isn't it?
That's correct. It was called Young Voices New Mexico, Rise, React, and Respond to, you know, this culture that we're living in where sexual harassment and rape culture is so pervasive. And these young people got together and created art to speak out against it.
And I was able to join you in that exhibition, and I was really mesmerized by the kind of work, the powerful works these young people presented there. So I want to share with our panel who are here, Bianca Villani, Community Education and Outreach Director at the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico, and Elena Giacci, who is also the chair of the Albuquerque Mayor's Domestic and Sexual Violence Task Force, we're going to share the testimony of a survivor who are going to call Julia, and she is sharing her experience in a very courageous way with us about what happened to her and what's the best, how did she try to heal or to overcome it.
So I grew up in Southern California. I'm not originally from New Mexico, so I grew up in Southern California, and I kind of grew up in one of those, like, movie-style suburbs where it was like, if you just pretend like things aren't happening, they don't happen, and that was sort of like our approach to everything. But so actually the community that I grew up in was struck with two tragic deaths of young women in the community, one when I was really young and one when I was a teenager. And both of them, it was like women who had experienced sexual violence and women who had been murdered. And I kind of grew up in a community where that was like the backbone of me growing up, but it was never talked about. And in the ways that it was talked about, it was very much like someone made a mistake somewhere, but there was nothing about how can we stop that from happening. So when I was in high school, actually, because I was like a straight A nerd growing up, I did robotics throughout high school. I was very invested in academics. And my junior year, one of my classmates was raped and murdered while she was going out for a jog. And it was a really big thing in my community. And our way of dealing with it is everyone was trained to take self-defense classes, and everyone was trained to take a buddy with them and to always let people know where you were and to make sure that that sort of thing never happened to you. And I guess I kind of went to college with that sort of mindset of like, cool, like I have my pepper spray, I have my pocket knife, you know, I know self-defense, like I'll make sure this never happens to me. And it was like empowering and it was strengthening to kind of come away from like such tragedy and to feel like, no, I can make sure that this doesn't happen. But then, yeah, my sophomore year in college, it did. And I think what made my rape so difficult for me to deal with is that it wasn't that stranger. It wasn't a random person. I wasn't in the wrong place at the wrong time. I was in my own bed and I was talking to a friend. And, you know, it was like, it was someone that I trusted, someone that I had invited into my personal space and someone that I sought help from. And I don't think I realized what was going on at first when he first put his hands on me. You know, it's just like it didn't matter that I knew self-defense. And when his hands first started moving up my thighs, I froze. And I entirely froze. And I felt like I couldn't move. And I feel like time simultaneously went incredibly fast. And didn't move. I feel like I can remember every moment, but it feels like a movie. It doesn't feel like something that I was there for because I felt like I should have been able to do something. And I didn't. And I mean, at the end, I was bleeding. And I remember him looking at me and saying, "It's okay. Sometimes this happens." And then he left my room. And this is a friend that I had had. And this is someone, I mean, he was in my room because I was talking to him about boyfriend problems. You know, I was trying to like talk to a friend about problems that I had in my life, you know, dumb college stuff. And I saw in him someone that I could confide in, and he saw in me someone who was vulnerable, someone who was there. And I mean, the whole time I remember thinking in my head, like, if I screamed right now, I was in the dorms. I was like, if I screamed right now, everyone would hear me. Anybody could come in. I remember thinking the RAs have keys. People have keys. People could get, I rarely even locked my door. I remember thinking if I made any noise, people could come in, but I couldn't move. And I've never felt something so petrifying and something so terrifying before because I couldn't move, even though I felt like I had been told everything of how I should be able to. And I mean, I beat myself up for years afterwards because of the fact that I didn't move and because of the fact that I didn't scream, because I didn't say anything. And it took me a long time to say anything afterwards. And it's like I had been trained of what I should do to stop it, and I couldn't do it. And I felt like that reflected on me, and that that meant that obviously the experience wasn't traumatic enough, because if it was really rape, then I would have been able to do something. And I couldn't do anything. And because of that, I think it took me a long time. I felt like I had done something wrong. And it took me a long time to be able to see past that.
Did you feel like you were guilty of that?
Yeah, I mean, all I could think about was like, I remember with my Girl Scout troop in high school taking self-defense classes. I remember them telling us these scenarios of the could-be rapist coming up to you. And like what you should do in that scenario. And I remember thinking I didn't do that. And thinking like, well, maybe that means, I don't know, maybe like I'm to blame. Like I didn't do something and that it's my fault. And the first few people that I told my boyfriend at the time. And I told another close friend. And it felt like neither of them really responded to it. And like my boyfriend was kind of mad at me. And just in the, well, why didn't you say something? Like, you had a boyfriend. Why didn't you say something? And I didn't have an answer. And I still don't have an answer other than that. I froze. And I didn't know what to say. And I still, like, I didn't know what to say or how to do anything in that moment. And I beat myself up for that.
When was the first time you were having the courage to ask for help if you did it?
I was raped in November of 2012. And it took me until October of the next year to really seek out help. And the only reason why I did is because this guy hacked onto my Facebook and he unblocked himself from my Facebook. And then he started sending me friend requests and he started sending me messages. And it was just like, I tried to say I did something wrong and I tried to put it behind me. And as soon as he tried to reach back out and put himself back in my life, I knew that, I couldn't put it behind me. It was there. And it wasn't something that I could just ignore. And I remember I just broke down and I told one of my friends. I was at her house at the time when it happened and she was there for me. And I started realizing that, I mean, it became harder to focus in classes. Mm-hmm. And like small things would just set me off and I would just start sobbing uncontrollably. Just small things would just trigger me. Like I remember I had a Spanish professor who he licked his lips and I broke down and it just brought me back into that moment and I had to leave and I dropped the class. And I started dropping classes left and right. And I mean, I had been a straight A student. I mean, I came to college with scholarships. My academics had always been very important to me. And I got to a point where I couldn't be in class and I was terrified to be out of my house. And I started telling some of my professors and I told one of my professors that I had had what was going on. And she listened to me. And I mean, she told me it wasn't my fault when I was still trying to convince myself that. And she helped me and she helped me to go to report it to UNM. And at that point, I mean, I started using the counseling at UNM. And I can't stress enough how helpful they were to me to have people there who I could talk to and who, again, would listen. Because the first few times when I tried to talk to people, I felt like they didn't listen and they didn't understand. And they just reaffirmed all the questions I had, all the guilt I was facing. And to start talking to someone that not only listened to me, but said, wow, like, that's horrible. Like, that shouldn't have happened. Like, it blew my mind, which is, like, horrible that that was something that I had to wait over a year to get out of a response from someone. But just hearing someone say, no, like, that's not okay. Like, that is not how you should be treated. Just totally changed my mind and totally, I mean, I still feel like today, I mean, I struggle sometimes where I still feel guilt. And I still feel like I wish I had done this. I wish I could have done this. I should have been able to do this. I mean, I obsessively research this kind of stuff. So I know that it's not my fault, but it's still a guilt that I feel. But just having someone in my life tell me that I don't need to feel that and it's okay if I do, but that I don't need to, meant so much to me.
If you're just tuning in, this is Women's Focus, and today our topic is because April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. My name is Christina Bacin, and we were listening to the first part of a survivor's testimony, in this case, Julia, who is sharing what happened to her and what did it mean to her, the sexual assault in her life. We are here with Bianca Villani, who is Community Education and Outreach Director at the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico, and Elena Giacci, who is the chair, among other tasks, chair of the Albuquerque Mayor's Domestic and Sexual Violence Task Force. What did inspire you, the words and the testimony of Julia?
Well, for me, I have to first let our survivor know what a brave and courageous thing, just speaking those words, because I think the things that she and the journey she's taking through this trauma is a very brave one, that she's letting people know how she feels, because part of what our survivors feel is so much isolation. People don't believe, so they feel isolated. People question, they feel isolated. And so by speaking her truth, it helps break that isolation and realize that other people are having those same feelings. And it's very, very common that our victims and survivors blame themselves. You go, what did I do wrong? And it's such a hard piece to walk through to convince yourself because everybody else is questioning you the same way?
You know, I really want to hone in on the part where Julia talked about the fact that in that moment she felt frozen. And it sounded as if she had even disassociated from her body because she said it felt like a movie to her, like she was watching it, but not in the movie. And this is a very common response that survivors have. And it's very hard for people who have never experienced sexual assault to understand this, that when we are in a very traumatic situation where we feel threatened, we will respond with a fight, flight, or freeze response. And the freeze response is particularly common amongst sexual assault survivors. And somebody can have training in self-defense. They can have training in, you know, they could be an MMA fighter. They could have a can of mace in their bag. And in that moment, they may not remember to use all of those things or how to use those things because the critical part of their brain, the front cortex that does all of that thinking for you is now paralyzed and you're just trying to stay alive and you're just trying to stay safe.
We are going to listen now the second part of the survivor of Julia, who is also sharing with us part of her healing process. And then we'll go back to our panel with, in this case, Bianca Villani, who was just talking to you, Community Education and Outreach Director of the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico, and Elena Giacci. Thanks for being here. We are going to listen to this second part and then back to our panel. How could you heal from that kind of trauma? Is it possible to heal of this kind of trauma? How do you feel today?
I mean, I think it's definitely possible to heal. Like, I mean, I don't think it's something that, like, goes away. I mean, I oftentimes when I hear people talk about sexual assault, they talk about it as this, like, loss where you lose something. Someone takes something from you. But I always felt it more like I had this extra presence. Like it was like something that I couldn't lose. Something was not only physically, but emotionally, mentally put inside of me that stays with me. And it's an experience. It's a memory. It's a sensation that I do still carry with me today. And I think it's definitely possible to heal. And I don't think that means that you don't continue to feel it. Because I still have days where I just sob. I still have days where it's really hard to leave my bed. And I still have days where it's difficult to talk to people, where it's difficult to trust people, to let people into my life. That still happens. And I don't think that means that I'm not healing. Because I think healing is learning how to live with that, learn how to grow from that, learn how to take that and say, well, I have this experience. And this experience is a part of my life now, but it doesn't define my life. Mm-hmm. And I can have a bad day, but I have good days with other stuff. And I can have days where I'm crying, but I mean, I also know I've had days where I laugh. And I've had days where I cry over other things. I mean, it's a part of me, but I don't think I'm like weaker or broken or smaller because of it. I think if anything, I've learned a lot from it. And I mean, after my rape, I mean, I changed college. I was trying to study chemistry. I was like, cool, chemistry has...
It doesn't nothing. Have anything yeah. to do with heart, with yeah. human beings.
I'm like, what am I going to do now with
how about
chemistry?
Mathematics?
And it's just, if I couldn't focus on stuff, like how was I going to... So I started studying more anthropology and more like history sort of stuff and looking at this violence because I think...
We're trying to understand it?
Yeah, uh-huh. Because I think on top of just acknowledging and accepting the fact that this experience now feels like it's a part of me, I sort of struggle with this idea of, okay, but it's something that people don't want to hear about. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's not like a tragedy where you tell someone and they're like, wow, like, thank you for telling me. You know, it's like that, like, room silencing sort of statement that you make and people, like, look at you differently. And they, like, want to give you chocolate but don't want to stay around to hear how the rest of your day went because you just become this rape victim. And so I think I went through, like, a phase of not wanting to tell people because being afraid of that. but then wanting to tell everybody because I didn't want to be overwhelmed with that. I was like, okay, let's just get it out. I'll like get it on the table now because I know it's going to come up at some point. I experienced rape. I'm a rape survivor. Now it's okay. Keep breathing because there's more to me. I'm also kind of funny sometimes and I play guitar. So like, let's get past that. And I sort of, I think in my life, I tried to normalize it, but it was hard because, I mean, up until my senior year in college, like even just saying the word rape would bring, my voice would shake. And still even now, I mean, I feel it. But I mean, it would, saying it, I would be feeling just that word for the next few hours. And I would, yeah, I would most certainly cry that night about it. Like just uttering, just hearing someone say the word. I mean, it would bring me back to everything that I felt in that moment, everything I felt afterwards, everything I felt and how people responded, everything I felt and how I held myself accountable for things that I didn't do. And so I think for me, one of my paths of healing was just like bringing back the word rape for me. So being able to say that this is my rape experience, that this is something that I experienced, and kind of putting ownership over my experience rather than letting someone else or letting other people's notions of what I went through kind of define what it was. And I think trying to talk to everyone that I met at a party and just say the word rape helped to really normalize it for me in a way that it didn't carry the weight that it once did. And I think healing is different for everybody. I mean, the way everybody recovers from everything is different. Like some people like get a cold and go about their day and they're totally fine. And some people get a cold and they're just in bed complaining the whole time. You know, it's, we all like deal with things in our lives differently. And I think that healing from sexual assault, healing from rape is no different. And I mean, I've spoken to some people that have been raped and their lives never stopped. They kept going. But I feel like my life stopped and totally changed course. And I just think people process things differently and there isn't any right way to heal. But for me, for sure, it was just like putting myself back in the position of power of what I experienced because I can't change what happened. But just giving myself ownership of my experience, I think, was like very meaningful in my healing.
You were talking about the fact that how other people were reacting to your story or when you were sharing. Some people can listen to that. Other people can't or they avoid it.
Well, I think the first thing that stands out for me with my experience is that like we're taught that rape is when like a bad man catches you in a dark alley and that's what it is. So I think just in talking to people, the fact that I was like, no, this is someone who I invited into my room and who I invited to sit on my bed. I mean, granted, it was a dorm room, so it's very small space, but I invited this person to sit on my bed with me. And I think that that right there, a lot of people are like, oh, it's not rape then. You invited them in. Like, you know the person. It's not rape. Maybe they misunderstood. So I think the idea of like how rape happens is very misunderstood. And I think that that was like one of the first uphill battles for me with my story that I faced. It's just people were like, oh, that's not rape. Oh, that person just had a crush. It's not rape. And like hearing that as like a rape survivor, you're like, no, but it is. Like, this is my experience. Like, you can't tell me what my experience is. And I think on top of that, the idea of what a rape victim needs to look like, I think that's why even now, as I talk to people, I mean, I met with this just like overwhelming sympathy where it's just they want to just like take care of you. And it's like, no, really, like I'm cool. Like that was horrible that that happened. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, I'm not okay. Like that's not okay that that happened. But like, I mean, I'm still going about my life, you know, like I don't need you to stop everything to take care of me. And I think a lot of people kind of in their mind, they see it as like, oh, this is the worst thing that could ever happen to someone like ever in their whole life. And it's like totally like it's really bad. And for some people, it is the absolute worst thing. But it's just this like over dramatization especially when not all survivors, not all victims need that. I think that that can be like a huge like turnoff for people when they're trying to talk to someone about what they experienced. I heard one of my favorite comedians, Barry Crimmins. He's a survivor of child sexual assault. And I heard him in an interview one time make this comment. It really stuck with me. Where?
What did he say?
He said that when he first started talking to people about, like, what happened to him, like, he was met with all these responses, and the interviewer was like, yeah, well, it's hard for you to, like, I'm sure it's hard for you to, like, admit what you went through and for you to admit what happened to you. Mm-hmm. He was like, well, wait a second. He was like, I'm not admitting anything. He was like, admitting implies guilt. And I didn't do anything. He's like, I'm disclosing. I'm choosing to say something. But he was like, I'm not admitting something because I did nothing wrong. And that sort of perspective really kind of changed how I viewed it. Because it did feel sometimes like when I told someone something, when I told someone like what happened to me, that they sort of saw it as I was telling them this deep, dark secret of mine. But I was telling them something that happened to me, something about me. And this idea of like admitting with like your own guilt and your own culpability in it versus like disclosing something that happened to you that you don't necessarily tell everybody. But that also isn't, you know, it's not a secret. Like there's plenty of things that we don't tell people. And I think a lot of people respond to disclosures with that sort of like, wow, like, I can't believe you're telling me this. Like, that's so horrible. And they sort of like, they feel everything. And it's like, well, I'm telling you this not so you can feel what I'm feeling, but just so honestly you can say, like, that sucks. Like, that's not okay. Like, can I help you? Like, that's horrible.
At this moment, we were talking about if it's possible to heal, how all this issue can is still affecting or not your life.
My rape still definitely affects my life. Like, not a day goes by where I still don't think about it. And I still don't think about how my life is different. I mean, I truly believe, like, had it not happened, I probably would have continued with chemistry. I probably would have been working in a lab somewhere. I probably would have been miserable doing it. But, I mean, I probably would have still continued pushing myself down that path. And I think for me, it was like a wake-up call that I had to do something else. But I mean, like, not to go into the statistics, but I mean, we know the likelihood of this sort of thing happening. And if it didn't happen to me then, the chances of it happening to me a few years later, the chances of it happening to a close friend of mine, someone else, I'm sure it would have personally affected my life at some point within the next few years had it not happened then. But it's definitely possible to overcome it, because even though I think about it every day, I mean, I still feel like I have like a very successful life. I mean, I have friends, I have a job, I have things that I enjoy doing, I have things that provide happiness for me. I'm able to exercise, I'm able to leave my house to go out places, and I still face anxiety about certain things. And I still have trust issues sometimes. It can be difficult for me to form like a meaningful, like emotional relationship with someone just because of that fear of like, well, what if this person tries something? Am I going to be able to do something different this time? What if it happens again? But I don't think the fact that I'm a rape survivor means that I can't also have a life outside of that. And I do think that it's possible to heal. And I do think it's possible to overcome those experiences. But I think it's important to really acknowledge that, because I do think that I have been able to get past certain things with it. I mean, I still have days where I can't leave my bed, and I still have days where it still really affects me. And there are still things that happen where it just brings me back to that moment, things that just remind me of everything. Sometimes I'll see the back of someone's head and I'll think that it's this guy. I'll think, well, what do I do? Like, do I say something to him? Do I tell someone, like, what happens if I see him? And I have seen him around town. And it just, like, it brings me back. And I just feel like I fall back down. But I think the fact that I also know that I have support in my life, where when that does happen, I have people who I can talk to. And I know places that I can go to for help. I mean, I think that that reassurance makes such a difference, because I didn't necessarily feel that when it first happened. And I didn't feel that when I reported my sexual assault. And it's in my friendships and it's in learning about resources in town that I really do feel more comfortable. Like, there are people that not only will believe me, but they'll listen to me and they'll support me. And I think that that reassurance helps me, even when I do feel like I'm brought right back down again, that I know that I can get out. And if I can't get out, I know I have someone that's going to make me get out at some point, because I have to pay rent and, you know, like, get out of my room. So it's like, I know I have these systems in place that will help me get past it. I think feeling like it's not something that I have to deal with alone really means a lot to me.
If you're just tuning in, this is Women's Focus, and today's show is about sexual assault awareness, because April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, Awareness and Prevention Month. We were listening to the testimony of Julia, a survivor of sexual assault, who was sharing with us her life, her experience, and the ways she's trying to cope with having been raped. In our studio, we are with Bianca Villani, Community Education and Outreach Director at the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico, and Elena Giacci, who is a Dine woman and the chair of the Albuquerque Mayor's Domestic and Sexual Violence Task Force, among other things. So I guess, we were listening all together with our listeners as well, this testimony. After listening to this, I was wondering if you can tell us, is this a case that represents the population in some ways? What are the most vulnerable people to be sexually assaulted?
So in New Mexico, we have identified populations that are more vulnerable to acts of violence, particularly sexual violence. And those populations are Native women, African Americans, immigrants and foreign-born individuals, people who are living with disabilities, and people who identify as lesbian, bisexual, gay, queer, questioning, or transgender. These are the individuals, populations who experience sexual violence at higher rates in New Mexico. And many of these people live in rural communities. And in rural communities, it's very difficult because there is a lack of resources, a lack of support. And so not everybody's able to access services to heal from their sexual assault, which is extremely vital. As you listened to Julia, that was how she was, you know, able to overcome a lot of what she was feeling, was because of the friends and the support that she received.
And so definitely when we take a look in, and given the nation, we look at the population of Native women, and unfortunately they're on the top of that bad list of being victimized so often. And we have to take a look, when we look at any type of violence perpetrated on Native community, when we start looking at that, we also have to take a look at the colonization and the racism that has been perpetrated, continues to be perpetrated on Native community. And taking a look at all of those pieces together gives you a better frame. And it's just like all of our underserved communities that Bianca was just talking about, is it's not just about that one community in this little tiny framework. It's because of all of the issues that surround underserved communities. And getting the services that Bianca was talking about, and it's very difficult in rural communities. They may not, especially on tribal lands, not have rape crisis centers, and so may not have a sexual assault nurse examiner close by, and may have to travel if they choose to do a forensic exam. May have to travel hours, and that says you have transportation. So we start adding all of these layers to that piece. But I would say that the question of, is this the story that she tells similar in nature to many of the other stories? I would say absolutely. And that makes it even more tragic because the commonalities are the self-blame and the commonalities of thinking that you should have been able to do something are very common. And yet it's one of those things that we have to let all of those people who have experienced that, just like our survivor did, is this is not your fault. It wasn't you to blame. And whatever course that you chose, whether it's not doing and not feeling like you're doing something, is indeed an action of making that choice of going, I can't do anything at this point in time. That's a right decision for you at that moment. And whatever that is, you did the right thing. And not to have any kind of blame attached to an action.
Is it common that the perpetrator is somebody that the victim knows?
Absolutely. And the younger that the individual is, the more likely it is going to be somebody who is in their family or in a very close social network of theirs. Yes, stranger rape does happen. And we teach people to prepare themselves for stranger rape all the time. And that's very dangerous because then we are not discussing this very silenced issue that it is somebody. This could be somebody that you know. It could be the person that you're dating. It could be your coworker. It could be your boss. It could be a local politician. It could be a police officer. It could be a priest. Anybody who looks like a regular individual. And that's very difficult for a lot of people to recognize because we want to associate a perpetrator with someone who looks like the stereotype that we were raised, you know, watching on television or TV shows or a Lifetime movie. And that's not the case. You know, this person could be young or old. They could be anyone of any gender. They could be of any sexual orientation, race, background. And that's a scary thought. But if we don't talk about it in that way, if we don't recognize this, then we are just living in the dark ages with this and we are not moving forward.
And when you look at Native communities, some of those statistics are a little bit different because we find that Native women are oftentimes, and especially in urban communities, more likely to be raped by a stranger, and especially a non-Native stranger. And so the statistics really show that kind of what the normal statistics we always thought were, and that was that it was someone you knew, changes a little bit for Native community in certain areas. And then when you look into more rural areas, then it starts falling into the same idea of that it's people that you do know. But what it comes down to is that trust is so violated. And the trust of knowing someone or caring for someone or like our survivor feeling very safe with someone and believing you can be that friend really takes you on so many different levels because then you say, well, what am I thinking? How did this happen? And you start doubting your own levels of understanding. And so that just adds another level of pain that you go through and knowing full well that this is not your fault. And that's a message I think Bianca and I are going to continuously and yourself bring up is it's not your fault. It's not your fault. And I don't think you can hear that too many times. This is not your fault. You did have nothing to do with this.
And I believe you.
Yes, absolutely.
And we are going to share another testimony of Sarah, another survivor, whose rape happened in a different way as the prior survivor we were listening to. And then we'll come back to Claire Harwell, who is also, she's the lead attorney and project creator at the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, along with our partner, Bianca Villani and Elena Giacci. So this is, be ready, because this is a very powerful testimony. And in this case, Sarah, who is experienced, she's sharing her experience and ways of coping with having been raped. This is Women's Focus today with you, Christina Bachin, sitting in for Carol Boss. She'll be back on May the 20th.
Okay. This happened in 1999. So it's been quite some time. I was 20 years old, and I had a couple of part-time jobs. One of them was at a local small clothing store. They also sold jewelry and some other things. And it was a family-owned store very close to New Mexico State University. And I was there right after the new year, so there weren't a lot of college students out, as typically were most of our clientele. And about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was working alone, and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, someone came, pulled up to the front of the store, a man alone walked in, and seemed just different, didn't walk all the way into the store, sort of scanned the room, shared a little conversation with me, and then left. And it was a very strange interaction for me, so I sort of had my instincts were telling me, you know, this is strange, this is not a normal situation, but he left, so I sort of had to calm myself down, and I tried calling a couple of people, and they didn't answer, which back then, not everyone had a cell phone, so it was more landline call, and then about 15 minutes later, he came back to the store. He had changed clothes. He came back to the store walking this time. He was not in his car. And he started a conversation with me, again, very strange, acting very strangely. And I started to think he was there to rob the store. But eventually, I kept trying to back away from him, and he kept approaching me, just getting closer and closer. And eventually, he punched me in the face, which broke my upper and lower jaw bones, knocked out teeth. And then we engaged in a pretty long fight. Initially, I tried to run for the front door after he punched me, but he grabbed me and had his whole hand down my throat so I couldn't scream or breathe. And eventually I, you know, decided that I was either going to fight or I was going to die. So I started fighting and bit him and scratched and wiped blood on the floor and on the countertops and anything I could. And eventually he dragged me into the store bathroom and sexually assaulted me. And I somehow thought that I could trick him into thinking that someone had gotten to the store. And again, it was a very small store, so the bathroom was sort of like a supply closet slash bathroom. So there are no windows. It was completely dark in there with the door closed. And so when he opened the door to check to see if someone had actually walked in, I was able to close the door and lock it and keep him from coming back in, which eventually he did take money from the register and left, at which point I was able to sort of decide that I was ready to walk out of the bathroom, which took a little bit of talking to myself about, okay, this is okay, I need to get out of here, I need to get some help, and eventually put on clothing from the store rack because he had taken my clothes with him. Which many of the items of clothing the police later found down the street. And eventually I called 911 and they arrived and I was taken by ambulance to the hospital. And that's pretty much the incident itself, what started, you know, that was the catalyst of all the change.
Is there a before and after of this kind of events in your life, like it happened in your life?
Absolutely. I often refer to even the 5 minutes before he walked into the store as normal. You know, that was my period of normal, where I was worried about regular things that 20-year-olds worry about. And I was pretty much, even though I felt stressed or worried about school or jobs or family and things like that, those became what I refer to as normal. I absolutely felt that I became a different person following the assault. And still to this day, I mean, it absolutely changed the course of my entire life.
In which way did it change your life?
So many ways. I think initially the first 6 months were, I was absolutely a victim. I started the process of going through many surgeries to repair my jawbones, to just physically recover. Also, I was emotionally just a mess. I couldn't use a bathroom alone for probably 3 months, even in my mom's house where I grew up, without my sister or my mom being right next to me or right in the other room where I knew they could hear me if I called out, which I knew on some level was illogical and not, you know, that didn't make sense. But my body just physically, the anxiety attacks, flashbacks, I was a very damaged person for probably 3 months. I was in therapy 2 times a week. I was put on antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, which I'm not a person who likes medicine, so it was very difficult for me to even take the medicine. But I knew on some level at that point that I needed help. So, you know, you go from being sort of this regular, go to the grocery store, do what you need to do person, to I was afraid to leave my house. There were points where, you know, my mom and family members had to physically force me to go to therapy, you know, by ushering me to the car and sort of making sure I was in a seatbelt. And I refer to it now. I say I had a very invasive support system because they absolutely made sure that I took care of myself when I was unable to make those decisions. Had it been up to me, I probably would have just stayed in my mother's house for I don't know how long, which would not have probably been very helpful. But that was the first, you know, probably, like I said, 6 months. It was a very dramatic change. And then eventually I had to come to the decision that I was either going to choose to have a life again, or I was going to not have a life anymore. I was going to end my life because I didn't want to live the way I was living anymore. And luckily I had an excellent therapist, and again, that family support and friend support that made me decide that I wanted to live and I wanted to have a great life. And I realized that I walked out of that bathroom that day for a reason. And it's honestly taken, it's been 18 years since my assault, and it took me probably a good 10 before I was able to really talk about it openly with others and feel strong in the fact that I was no longer a victim.
10 years?
I would say it was a good 10 years, yeah, before I really felt strong about it and didn't feel ashamed or embarrassed or vulnerable in talking about it openly.
Do you think it's is it possible to overcome it?
I do. I really do. I, you know, another strange sort of twist to my assault was that it was a stranger attack, which is not the common statistic. I was at work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, broad daylight. So there are a lot of things that are different. And they had no suspect for 13 years. And, you know, I had already sort of made a new life for myself and definitely imagined in my head that my attacker was dead. And that was how I was able to move on with my life. And then 13 years later, a detective came knocking at my mom's door because she lived in the same house, you know, for a very, very long time. And that's where they were able to sort of track me down. And they, you know, he sat down and sort of nonchalantly told me, we have a DNA match in your case from 1999. And it just sort of was a brand new upheaval of everything that I had sort of come to. Once again, the new normal was now in upheaval, and I had to deal with that, and we had to deal with going to court and going to trial.
Revive everything again.
Yeah, it was interesting. That was tough. That was a very much. It was different. It's very different to have to sit in a room with this person. Definitely brought back a lot of things. I mean, and not just physically. I mean, I physically reacted when he walked into the room, and it's not. Several people, you know, several of the people that walk into the courtroom, they're in jumpsuits, they're shackled. You don't know who's who. They don't have like a sign on them that says why they're there. But I immediately knew who he was. And eventually we didn't go to trial. He eventually changed his plea after three different trips to the courtroom. But reading through police files and having to be questioned by attorneys, his attorney and the assistant district attorney on my behalf, that was tough. Even all those years later, it was really tough.
Did you feel like you were respected during that process or not?
In many ways, yes. And in some ways, no. I think, And I don't think it was an intentional disrespect. I think there is sort of a systemic flaw that separates the people that are trying to do their job, such as the assistant district attorney and the detectives. They are so detached from what the victim is going through or has gone through because they have a job to do. And on some level, I understand that. They need to do that in order to not carry other people's burdens with them emotionally or otherwise. But at the same time, I think there were a lot of things that, you know, the assistant district attorney, though I had met with him several times until I was being interviewed by the defense attorney, didn't know the extent of my injuries until I was being interviewed by the defense attorney, which I just found sort of ridiculous because he hadn't A, read through the files, and B, just hadn't ever even bothered to ask me. And I was still, I mean, it's been 18 years. I just had a surgery last year because they're still trying to get my jawbones to where they line up correctly and to where they're not deteriorating just due to the trauma from that long ago. So it's definitely something that impacts me, not just emotionally, but it's physically, financially, and psychologically continuing to affect my life. So the fact that he sort of just skipped over that. And then even, you know, eventually my attacker was sentenced to 9 years. And following that, when they ran the DNA through CODIS, there was actually another match that came up for a woman in Colorado. And he will also face charges for that rape after he serves time here in New Mexico.
So he was a repetitive perpetrator?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What would you recommend to somebody who is listening to you and who might have suffered something similar, or somebody our listener would might know or be in touch with? There is something after all this experience that you would recommend to a victim of this kind of crimes that you would share from your experience?
I think having all these years just reflect on what happened to me and how the system handled what happened to me, and listening to other women who have stories of sexual assault or domestic violence, it is a very extremely personal, the most personal type of violence that a person can be involved in. And there is a lot of stigma around the word rape. There's a lot of stigma around what a victim of rape looks like. And for people that have experienced it, sometimes that may keep you from wanting to talk about it. That may keep you from feeling like you can share with others what happened to you. And I did the same for a long time. Even though, you know, I was not culpable in any way, shape, or form, it definitely, that stigma, that fear of being judged, and of not being healed myself well enough to discuss it, kept me from talking about it. But eventually I realized that somebody needed to be a voice, and I decided that I wanted to be one of those voices. And I would encourage people absolutely to find your support system, whether it's family, chosen family, therapist, and really be honest with yourself about healing and what it takes to be able to get to a place where you can function again. I think that it's not something you can handle by yourself. No matter how strong you are, no matter how many other things you've taken on in your life, this is not one of those things. It's also not one of those things that you can deal with by just pushing away and suppressing and pretending it never happened, because I tried that too. And that, you know, I moved to another state where no one knew me and sort of tried that out. And, you know, it's not something you can do alone. And I would also say that you're definitely not alone. Just looking at statistics in New Mexico alone, there are unfortunately a lot of women and some men and unfortunately children that are in your situation. So don't feel like you're alone. Don't feel like this has never happened to anyone before.
Hello?
Yes, sorry.
No, it's okay.
I just think seeking out help, seeking out those support systems.
If you're just tuning in, this is Women's Focus, and in this show we are working and talking and about sexual assault awareness and prevention, as April is the month to work more on that, but actually is a type of a crime that we need to work even more. We were just listening to a survivor's testimony. Let's say she is Sarah, and she was sharing in a very courageous way, as the same happened with the first survivor's testimony, about what happened to her and the ways of healing as well. We are here in the studio with Bianca Villani, Community Education and Outreach Director at the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico, and Elena Giacci, the NEG Woman and Sexual and Domestic Violence Training Specialist and Advocate for American Indian and Alaska Native Peoples. They have been listening along with you, the same testimony here in the studio, so I'm going to ask them, what's the first thing that triggers to you this kind of testimony, and how can we help to our listeners to interpret this more?
Well, once again, I think we're as part of the audience who listens to those survivor stories, is the strength that it takes. I think some of this survivor's story, being a stranger and having that unknown out there, like she was talking about, is who might this person be, and what might this person show up at any point in time, is a very common one, because even though it might be a stranger and you may never see that person again in your life, the idea is that you don't know that, and that that peace that sits there and is a constant reminder. But what I really appreciated what she was talking about was that she had tried all of the different types of avoiding that peace in her head to let's just go on. And I've heard that hundreds of thousands of times from women. It's like, yeah, it happened. I'm just going to go on. And unfortunately, it's not that simple. And all the different things that she tried wasn't successful until she started that real true journey of walking and healing and talking to other people and connecting and being in that place helped support her in that journey. And I think that's critical so that being able to talk to someone, reaching out to people, telling your story, however you want to tell that story, and then having it be believed is critical.
Bianca, we are with Bianca. You were just listening to Elena Jachi in our studio. Bianca Villani, you were just listening to this story, I know. And what does inspire you? How can we help our listeners to bring more aware about this topic? What can we do in our community to change? What did my first thinking was, what can we do to reduce it? And I thought, why to reduce? We need to eliminate this kind of crime.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, I want to thank that survivor for sharing that story. That must have been extremely difficult, particularly because she is still physically healing from it, as she mentioned. And healing is not linear. So she's doing everything that she can to wake up each and every morning and be herself and be true to herself, but also recognize that she has been through a lot and will probably continue to go through a lot. Going back to what you mentioned, how do we decrease sexual assault? How do we eventually eradicate it, eliminate it, so that the next, you know, generation and future generations don't even have to have this in their vocabulary, in their language? What I will say is it's going to take time. It's going to take a culture shift. We are all individually going to have to look at ourselves, take a good close look at ourselves and ask ourselves, are we using words, language, actions, or behaviors that's contributing to this culture? Because our silence is a contribution to that. Even if we're not the bad guys or the bad girls or the bad people doing these things, perpetuating these crimes, our silence is still, it's just contributing to this culture. And so we have to look at ourselves. You know, what language are we using in the locker room? You know, we heard a lot about locker room banter.
Yeah.
This especially past year.
By this, by our president. We didn't mention him yet. We are talking about culture, and we are in this culture where that kind of man was elected as the main leader of this country, who doesn't respect women.
And I bring that up because sexually violent and aggressive language, language that is obviously non-consensual, is sexual assault. Violence is violence. It doesn't matter whose mouth it comes out of. It's violence. We have to recognize that, and we cannot excuse it by calling it, you know, locker room banter or saying boys will be boys or any of those things. We have to accept that we are living in a rape culture, but recognize that we can combat it. We don't have to. We don't have to stay silent. If you're, you know, avid on social media, if you have a presence on social media, stand up and say something. If you work in an office where people look up to you, you're influential, you know, do a presentation. Use a lunch hour to talk about sexual assault. It doesn't have to be April for you to talk about sexual assault. If you're a parent, a grandparent, take your, you know, your young people aside and ask them if they know what consent is. Ask yourself, do you know what consent is? Do you know what that means to gain and ask permission? And what happens when someone declines your offer? What do you do? Do you accept that or do you continue to push further? Right? And then I want to tell people that they're not alone. You can go to resources. The Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico exists because we are a community resource. We're here for you. If you have questions about how do I talk to my child about consent? how do I, you know, teach my son to respect women? Call us. We can help you. I want to learn more about active bystander techniques. We can show you and teach you how to be an active bystander. We're here. We're a resource. You're not alone.
I want to share with our listeners as well, like a legal point of view of this issue. We are on Women's Focus today. I'm sitting in for Carol Boss. My name is Cristina Bacin, and in our studio with me, Bianca Villani, Community Education and Outreach Director at the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico, and Elena Giacci, who is the chair of the Albuquerque Mayor's Domestic and Sexual Violence Task Force. We are going to listen to Claire Harwell, who just, she can't be here because she was just nominated for 2017 Visionary Voice Awards by the National Sexual Violence Research Center. She is a lawyer and she's the lead attorney in the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs. We're going to listen to her, and especially what does it mean, sexual assault in New Mexico? First of all, Claire Harwell, I want to congratulate you for being nominated by the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Program in this 2017 Visionary Voice Awards. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Was it a surprise for you?
It was a surprise, yes. It's a national award, and it's very flattering.
As we are sharing the Sexual Assault Prevention and Awareness Month, so the first question I would like to ask you is, since you are more than an advocate about this topic, as you are the lead attorney and project creator and director of the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs, how the law enforcement and justice system work regarding this type of assault? And is there to be something to be improved?
There's always room for improvement. Sexual violence is a very difficult crime to prove, and that's more because of where we are culturally than anything else. We are still in a place where we are, as a culture, very suspicious of women's narratives of what has happened to their bodies. And we, as a culture, need to take responsibility for educating ourselves about what we know about this particular crime. There's been quite a lot of research now, more than a quarter century of research. I'm sorry, more than 3 decades of research. And in that period of time, we've learned some things that we know for sure. For example, the vast majority of assailants are people that are known to the survivor. The vast majority of assailants commit more than one of these crimes. The vast majority of these crimes don't involve weapons. They involve utilizing social situations and social expectations. They involve using alcohol as if it's a weapon, both to make someone unable to resist and also to make someone be less believable. So there are a number of things that we know about these crimes that actually are perhaps counter to what the larger culture believes to be true about sexual violence.
In New Mexico, how sexual assault is defined as a crime?
So New Mexico has many different what are called tiers of offenses, and they relate to sort of various ways that sexual assault might occur. So sexual assault can be a first-degree crime or it can be a fourth-degree crime, depending upon what happens and how the perpetrator commits the crime. And all of that is pretty relevant to how the individual survivor feels about it, because the individual survivor is likely to have the same level of trauma, no matter what level of crime was committed against her or him. So there are a lot of different configurations in our law. There are what's called criminal sexual penetration crimes, which obviously are penetrations of the orifices that are involuntary or done in a situation where someone can't possibly give consent. And then there's criminal sexual contact, which is a whole variety of ways that people can be touched in a sexualized kind of way, involuntarily and in a way that's about domination and harm.
In the case of New Mexico, how our justice system work regarding this? What's your opinion? First of all, how does it work?
To initiate a criminal case, one reports to the police and the police do their investigation, and that gets referred to the district attorney's office for screening. And the district attorney's office makes a determination about whether or not it's a case they can prosecute. And the district attorney's office communicates that information to the crime victim. And if the district attorney's office chooses to prosecute the case, then the crime victim becomes a witness in the state's case. So that's sort of generally the process on the criminal side. On the civil side, which is a case where someone goes after damages and some sort of concession, oftentimes from the entity that's being sued, then one would need to get your own attorney. Often those cases are taken on contingency, which means that the individual who's been harmed doesn't have to lay out a lot of money initially in order to get a lawyer. The lawyer is paid based on what the damages are at the end of the case.
In your point of view, is this something that might need some sites to be improved?
It's a long process and it's a very punishing process for an individual who's been psychologically traumatized. And I think we have a long way to go before we are processing sexual assault allegations in a way that is even-handed and that would feel to someone who's had the experience as if they have attained some measure of justice. I think that's a very long ways away.
If you're just tuning in, this is Women's Focus. Today we are talking and sharing a conversation because of April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but it's not only April to work on this topic. And this afternoon we are sharing, we were just listening to Claire Harwell, who is director of New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs. And in the studio, Bianca Villani, Community Education and Outreach Director at the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico, and Elena Giacci. We have some minutes to share with our listeners something like, what can we recommend to do in our cultures? We already were talking about, let's wrap up this topic. And if we can do, after all what we have listening to share with our listeners, to also recommend places to go or what to do, let's say that.
Well, what I will say is that there is hope in darkness, always. You know, these were some very intense stories that we heard. We talked about some extremely difficult things today. But don't lose your faith in humanity. You know, don't fall down that dark vortex of reading, you know, trolls' comments, you know, on the internet, especially if it's a case regarding sexual assault, because that's where victim blaming lives. You know, there is hope. The majority of us are not doing these crimes. The majority of us are good people, and we have a lot in common. And what we have in common is that we all want to feel safe, and we all want to live free of sexual violence. And like I said earlier, we can start doing that by talking about consent more, making it an intergenerational conversation. If you know someone directly or indirectly who's been affected by sexual assault, and they choose you as the individual that they want to disclose to, be ready to listen, validate, and support. Even if you don't know what to say in that moment, just say, I hear you, I see you, and I'm honored that you chose me to tell this story to because this is a very difficult time for you. And refer them to resources if you know of any. You know that the Rape Crisis Center of Central New Mexico is here in Albuquerque at 9741 Candelaria Northeast. You know, we have a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week hotline, and that's 505-266-7711. And you can always refer to someone in that hotline. And the last thing I want to say is practice self-care. You know, people who are doing this kind of work, we're always talking about self-care, but really, like, do what you need to do to maintain your sanity. You know, take a bath, have a glass of wine, go for a walk, go for a hike, see your friends and your family. Do what makes you laugh and feel good, so that there is that balance while you're working to combat and end sexual violence with us.
And for me, I think one of the biggest pieces is first to recognize the bravery of the survivors who still walk out there feeling very alone, and letting them know that there are people who will listen. There are people out there to be able to support you. If we're looking at the long view of sexual violence and rape in our communities, part of it is having a healthy discussion about what healthy sexual behavior is and having an active one. And that starts from the very young age, doing appropriate language to talk about what that means. Because until we have that discussion, it's also very difficult to understand what unhealthy sexual behavior is and how you can respect your body and other bodies of, you know, the world, so that you know how to appropriately act, so that we eliminate the violence in our words that Bianca was talking about earlier, and that there is no, and we would never hear, locker room behavior or boys will be boys, because that is not an excuse for poor behavior. And that we have to ask our brothers, our uncles, our grandpas, our men in our community to stand up and say, this is wrong, and this is not who I am, and this is not what I will put up with. Then we look at our women and our sisters, and that we as sisters have to be more supportive of each other and not point the finger and not sit there and believe that there is blame to be put on when someone has had this terrible thing happen to them. And we need to let them know that they are not to blame, that they are not alone, and that we want to be able to help and support that component of healing. And when we come around to all of those pieces, we need to remember that most of all, we're relatives, and how we act on this Mother Earth is how we should be acting and treating each other. And when we treat each other with disrespect, that just ends up hurting our community, our people, and all the things that we think and hold most sacred. So we need to sit there and listen. Listen well. Let people know that they're not alone. Let people know that you believe them. Just in that, the power of believing someone who is crying out and saying, this happened to me, and not pointing the fingers. That is the strength in our community. Just like Bianca says, the majority of who we are brilliant and caring people and compassionate people. And we need to see that actively more and more as we see the negative encroach into our communities, and deliver the message that we are strong and we won't put up with it.
I want to thank you, Elena Giacci, for being here, and Bianca Villani for sharing this show. For all of us, I've been working a lot on this topic, and it's just to approaching it to it is very difficult. I want to thank also Claire Harwell for sharing her opinion about how the system, the judicial system, work. And especially I want to thank our two survivors who shared their stories, Julia and Sarah. And I want to finish this part of the show with Julia's recommendations. What does she think? I was asked her if somebody is listening to her, what would she recommend? Thank you so much to you, Bianca and Elena, for being here.
Thank you.
I think the first thing is that sex should be an enjoyable experience. It should be something that's happy, that's wanted. And if someone isn't feeling that, and if someone's questioning, was this okay, what happened to me? Is someone questioning, I don't know if I wanted this, then, I mean, that's not okay. And they're not talking about just an experience that they didn't enjoy. If this is something that they didn't want to happen to them, that someone else chose to do to them, then, I mean, we're talking about sexual assault. We're talking about someone choosing to hurt someone. And I think for a lot of people, they question their experiences because so much of trying to talk to people about it is just listening to other people question your experiences. But if someone's feeling like something happened to them that they didn't want, I mean, listen to that feeling and respect that that's your feeling. And it's horrible that for a lot of people, disclosing to people can be met with mixed reactions, and they can be met with people questioning, with people not believing. But there are so many people out there that will listen, and it's important to find those people. And I mean, if that's friends, if that's family, if that's coworkers, professors, teachers, whoever it is, because there are people that will believe these stories, because we know overwhelmingly these stories are true and there's no reason not to believe them. So I think I'd recommend for anyone out there who may be experiencing this, who may be dealing with this right now, is to really listen to yourself, listen to how you're feeling, and respect that, because you know yourself best, and it doesn't matter what other people say. It doesn't matter what people in the media, what people on TV, what anyone says about sexual assault. You know yourself best. And if this is something that's happening, there are people out there that can help and that will believe you.
Let's imagine our listener who is somebody like you and is listening to you. What would you tell to her or to him?
I mean, first of all, I believe your experiences, and I'm sorry that that happened, because it shouldn't have. There's no reason why it should have. And whatever you do next is your choice, because you're in charge of yourself. You're in charge of your life. And when we're talking about rape, this is someone else choosing to do something to someone without them being okay with it. But everything that you do after that, it's up to you. If it's something where you feel like you want to seek help, you want to talk to a therapist, a professional, I mean, that can be helpful, but it's not for everybody. If it's something that you want to report, that you want to try to take legal action on, that's another option. But the most important thing is for you to figure out what you're comfortable with, and it's not up to anybody else to decide what that is. So listen to where you're at and kind of figure out what do you need in this moment, what will help you, because there's no one way to deal with being raped, and there's no one way to get help. And there's plenty of avenues for things that you can do and people who can help guide you through that. But there's no one thing that you have to do if this is something that has happened to you.
Thank you so much for for sharing your story with us, for sharing your story with our listeners. And also, I want to tell you that I'm really sorry that something like this happened to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Also, it's always important to keep in mind, I mean, take care of yourself. And these aren't easy things to talk about, and they're certainly not easy things to deal with. So it's important to find things that also bring you happiness. So whether that's exercising or watching an embarrassing amount of Netflix while eating a tub of ice cream or taking a bath, whatever you want, make sure to also take care of yourself and try to find things that bring you enjoyment. Whether they're small things, big things, whatever. Because again, this stuff isn't easy. So it's important to make sure that you can do whatever's in your power to make yourself feel better, if that's what you need as well.
You are, if you're just tuning in, this is Women's Focus. Today we were focusing on sexual assault awareness and prevention, as April is the month on which we work more, a topic that we want to be in the focus as much as possible, to work on it, to improve the situation. And I want to really thank all our guests, but especially to thank our survivors who were sharing their stories with us. Stay tuned, because in just a few minutes we'll have an interview with an artist who is Simone de Baz, who is working in an exhibit about ethnic Madonnas. My name is Cristina Bacin, today sitting in for Carol Boss. Carol Boss will be back with you on May the 20th.